frequency waves, more than the higher frequency waves, of a broadband radio burst. That gives you a hint as to how many billions of miles away, or billions of, they believe it's a number of billions of light years away of these radio bursts that they're seeing. They occur quite a few times per year, depending on how many directions you're looking at. It's not in line with the plane of our galaxy, and the amount of energy of these bursts is equivalent to the amount of energy emitted by the sun in 10 billion years, and you get it in a few milliseconds. That's a lot of energy. As we've been saying before, when it comes to the gamma ray bursts and now these fast radio bursts that they're discovering, no matter what detector you put into space, periodically Mother Nature is going to saturate your detector. There are violent events going on out there, and they're speculating, what is this? Is it a neutron star crashing into a black hole? Is it a star being eaten by a black hole? What in the world can create that amount of burst of energy, such a strong amount of energy, for such a brief period of time? Lots of speculations as to what it is. But similar to those gamma ray bursts, let me drop them. One of the approximations of the gamma ray burst is that if it occurs within 22 light years of where we are, the nearest star to us is Proxima Centauri, 4 light years away. So 22 light years away is quite a few times further away than the nearest star. If a gamma ray burst occurs that close, it'll cook every living item on this planet. Is that the possibility of what created those mass extinctions? There was something like 5 mass extinctions on planet Earth in our history. So these guys are now sending articles back and forth to each other with the interpretation of these fast radio bursts that are now being discussed. And I don't think it's related to the time portals that you're talking about, Wes. And by the way, I know that, Wes, one of your main goals is to find more efficient ways of generating energy. And although I know that's an extremely difficult goal, and I don't believe the Wes I know would not be giving that one up. Temporarily, maybe you're slowing down on that one, but I'll bet you're going to go back to it. Am I correct on that one, Wes? N2XJN, K2LIW in the thick net.
N2IS.
N2XJN. No, I didn't give it up. I'm still working on it. It's just that I don't advertise it. It doesn't make any sense. But I believe that I have a certain achievement, and I believe that I have a certain recognition which among the group of people very much involved in it. And I believe also that I am not for making money on it, at least not for myself only. If it would be possible, I want to give it away. Let me drop. And it's not because I'm so good and that I'm so human. No. There is no other way. Coming back to the discussion in lab, it was already achieved. If you look at the articles that I have sent you, they say about magnetic reconnection phenomena in lab, and also observed in astronomical plasma as well. The process is initiated in a small diffusion region around magnetic X-line, and its consequences are large scale. And they state about the understanding of the structure of the diffusion region and the controlling rate at which magnetic energy is converted to particle energy. So now we're talking about not only energy connected to mass connected, converted to the energy, we're talking about a magnetic energy now converted to mass. Let me drop. And they say on the same article on 2003, January 14, about the Cluster 1 spacecraft detected passage of large-scale near-planetary current sheet, and that was the physical spacecraft that was sent to investigate those planetary clusters. And they talked about the speed relation whatsoever and how it looks like and what it does. So we're talking about either need of new relativistic physics, or at least a correction to it or new explanation to it. But anyhow, it's not something that we might now talk about the gamma rays, which are somehow uncatchable, which means something that you keep in your hand, sort of. Enter a gene.
I did hear somebody wanted to sign in. Was that K2IZ that I heard that I wanted to sign in?
That's AC2IS. And sorry, I forgot what my comment was going to be.
AC2IS, what is your name, sir? And maybe you had a question or a comment.
This is AC2IS, Phil, and no comment at the moment.
And I should recognize you, Bill. You and I haven't talked for some time. And maybe I should put Chris on to say a few words to you. Did you manage to put an antenna on your house, Bill? I know that you were trying to make improvements as your method of getting into the repeater. AC2IS, K2LIW.
No, Dick, I'm not at the home location right now, which is why I've got a clear shot into your repeater. I have, I guess, a project underway that I have not gotten back to for a long time. I've got parts sitting over at Babylon Town Hall.
And, Bill, did you have to drive to a hilltop in order to get good coverage to this repeater? I believe that your house is in a bit of a valley, and therefore getting RF out of that valley is not easy. So did you have to drive to a nearby hill, Bill? AC2IS, K2LIW.
I am nearby the work location. Yeah, kind of a better elevation than there, though. That's also in a valley.
Yeah, but the work location is considerably closer to the repeater than your home QTH. And one of the directors of LIMARC is living in your town, rather nearby to you. So, do you need some help with putting that antenna on the roof, Bill? Chris and I could give you a help. AC2IS, K2LIW.
Thanks for the offer. Right now, I still need to get a few more parts to complete the antenna itself. I have some mounting hardware, but I think it's not quite ready for that yet.
Yeah, to bring you guys up to speed, Bill came over to my house once and helped me install a fiber optic cable between the house and the radio tower to communicate with some of the radio equipment there. And so it'll be fair if Chris and I help him install an antenna in his house so that he doesn't have to travel away from home in order to talk. When K2UIH, Dr. Alan Katz I'm trying to think of the name of the... It used to be called the Trenton State Teachers College. It's now got a brand new name, but anyhow, he's the electrical engineering professor there. And 20 or so years ago, there was a series of articles in CQ Magazine where Dr. Katz had his, I believe it was a 24-foot diameter stressed parabolic dish antenna in which he was doing moonbounce experiments with it. Let me drop. And the good news is that the dish had lots of gain, the moonbounce worked, and the dish was located on top of a mountain at a piece of property that he was in, that he was renting, and I think that piece of property was something like 30 miles away from his house. And what Dr. Katz soon realized is that you've always got a conflict of interest. He had an extremely good location for this radio telescope plus moonbounce antenna, a very good location, that when the band is open and he was there, he has a lot of fun with us. When there's a weekend going on with radio, with moonbounce, when depending on the geometry of where the moon is and where we are in our orbit around the sun, and when you aim your antenna at the moon, how much background noise you're getting from the galaxy. If the galaxy, at the center of our galaxy, which is a loud radio noise generator, happens to be located directly behind the moon on this particular day of the month, then your moon bounce is going to be a lot less successful. So what Alan Katz soon discovered was that when the conditions are good, you're at home. When you're at the good location site, the conditions are not so good. If you're, the bottom line of all this is that if your Sirius ham radio equipment is not co-located with your place of residence, then you are always going to be a little bit unhappy. You're in the wrong place at the wrong time, a significant percentage of the time. When it comes to the 10 gigahertz operations that I do, let me drop. A hell of a lot of the guys that are doing 10 gigahertz, knowing that it's reasonably line of sight most of the time, but there's exceptions to that. So they go to mountaintops and beachfronts with their tripods and their 2 and 3 foot diameter dishes and their portable equipment to do 10 gig operations during the microwave contest. And I, for one, wanted to do that from home. So at the top of my tower, I mounted the 10 gig dish and put the electronics behind it and fed all the signals up to it by way of a coax cable. In other words, the real converter that converts 144 megahertz, my tunable IF, up to 10 gigs, that electronics is located in a box behind the dish on top of the tower. And so I've talked to guys in 10 states from home with a 2 foot dish on the top of the tower using 200 milliwatts of solid state power, single sideband. 10 states, best distance is 380 miles. So with a little bit of effort, a home installation is very possible. I now notice that the San Bernardino Microwave Society, in their latest monthly newsletter, is telling their guys to do just that. Even though almost everybody has the philosophy in California, you go to the nearest mountaintop when you want to do microwave operation. Let me drop. And so the president of the San Bernardino Microwave Society Club is convincing their members to do some radiating from home. Even if you can't get the antenna high enough, just act as a beacon to see how many other people can listen to you. And these guys were not even willing to try operating from home. And as they start operating from home, they find some of them are in a lot better condition than they thought. If they're willing to put up a tower, things get a lot better. And the guys in California, not many of them put up a tower at their house because there's lots of zoning restrictions in California. It's a lot more difficult. But one of the things that Paul Ray, W1 gigahertz, has been doing experimenting with, I've been a real enthusiast of a so-called periscope antenna system. In other words, you put a 45-degree fly swatter up at the top of the tower. You put an illuminating parabolic dish down at the bottom. You aim the signal straight up, bounces off the fly swatter at a 45-degree angle, and goes straight out to the sky. That kind of a microwave antenna system, called a periscope antenna system, has got some huge advantages. Rather than 14 dB of loss per, 4.5 dB of loss per 100 feet with the best waveguide you could buy going up the tower, rather than 4.5 dB of loss, by using this beam waveguide, that aiming the dish up at the fly swatter and then it deflects the signal out to the horizon, you end up with gain instead of loss. It's only 0.5 dB of gain. And where's the gain coming from? The fact that you're illuminating the fly swatter with a much better amplitude distribution, therefore it gives you more gain than it ordinarily would of the exact same area as a parabolic dish at the top of the antenna, at the top of the tower. So one other thing I want to mention to you guys, let me drop... And that is the latest issue of IEEE monthly magazine, IEEE Spectrum, is talking about the fact that the fifth generation of cell phones being experimented with by Samsung right now are using frequencies between 3 gigahertz and 300 gigahertz. And you use frequencies that high, you get some fantastic bandwidth, frequencies that have never been used before, they're not crowded, and you download movies at real fast rates into your cell phone-like device. And so it looks like there's going to be a lot of work at much higher frequencies. And I started thinking about what all this means. There was a very famous book by Clinton DeSoto. Clinton DeSoto had a book, a very famous book, somewhere around 1920, which was entitled 200 Meters and Down. 200 meters is 1.5 megahertz. In other words, the broadcast frequencies, the broadcast AM broadcast channels went up to 1.5 megahertz. And, let me drop. The broadcast frequencies went up to 1.5 megahertz. And everyone used to believe that the higher frequencies at 1.5 megahertz were useless. And it was given over to the ham radio operators. All of a sudden, by way of ionospheric reception, the TX, they started finding out how useful that was. That scenario has been repeated over and over again. The next higher band is considered to be useless, give it to the ham radio operators, and they discover how useful it is. Every decade, we go another decade higher in frequency. And so, right now, the frontier frequencies are numbers like 300 gigahertz. And not too many years ago, way back in 1920, everything above 1.5 megahertz was considered super high frequency. Pretty soon the hams proved how useful it was, and you had shortwave radio stations that got created, and so on. So every 10 or 15 years, the progressive ham radio operators go about 10 times higher in frequency. You'd be amazed how many of the guys will sign off on their microwave reflector submittals by putting a sentence at the bottom that says, no frequency is too high, or no frequency is high enough. Every time you go higher in frequency, develop good equipment for it, you discover much better methods of propagation, much better ways of sending high frequency, high bandwidth signals with much more reliability. Let me drop. So, so-called higher frequencies that always look like they're useless. They never are. We keep rediscovering that over and over again. And so Samsung is taking the lead on that and now working on cell phone-like devices, fifth generation, they're calling them, that are going to go up to 300 gigahertz. What is 300 gigahertz? I think that's something like 384 times higher than 2 meters. Many of us used to think 144, 146 megacycles, 2 meters, was a real high frequency. For the really progressive guys now, that's not a frequency, it's an IF. And in some cases, it's the second IF of the system. So it's relative. If we have any further comments on all of the above, give me a call at us right now. K2RFW in the TechNet.
Again.
Yes, you are getting through. So go ahead with your comments, Bill. And I can hear you on the input, so go. Phased arrays, electronic steering, beam forming networks, these are some of the buzzwords. You You Google those words, go to Wikipedia, and start realizing how it works. Nowhere near as difficult as you think. As long as you're willing to divide that signal coming out of the antenna into more than one radiating element, more than one dipole, more than one monopole, or whatever, you can steer the beam electronically in microseconds, if that's what you want to do. To electronically steer as opposed to mechanically steer, one has a huge advantage over the other. And there's all kinds of ways you can shape that beam after you steer it. You can make it broadband, narrowband, and beam width. Broad beam width, narrow beam width, I should have been saying. And so, right now, even with LTE and these fourth generation type cell phone type things, all those frequencies are being booked so solid, being so used and overused right now, the crowding is so significant. Let me drop. That it's running into a bit of a problem. And so you're way ahead of the game to go to the higher frequencies where no one is there yet, where you can get a lot more gain and directivity out of a small size antenna and squirt the signal in the exact direction where you need it and get a lot more usefulness out of it. For those who are hearing signals that shouldn't be there by going to the reverse mode on your rig, you can please report to us what you heard, how loud it was, and when you heard it by going to rfi@limark.org. RFI stands for Radio Frequency Interference, so report to us at rfi@limark.org. Give us the exact time and what you heard, how strong it was. And he mentioned earlier, that information is very much appreciated. Teacher RIW is listening.
With this Wi-Fi gear. The best I've seen in terms of range, but that's at the limits of the range of each radio, performance is very poor, and then there's a very wide band of poor performance, a very large physical range distance where performance is poor.
Yeah, there are people complaining about the fact that these super high frequencies where you can't generate a whole lot of power and the effective capture area of the antenna starts getting small, therefore you don't get kilometers of range, you get hundreds of meters of range. And as bad as that sounds, as long as you're willing to build out enough micro cell sites, so to speak, you can achieve that. And there's a lot of advantage in making a system which has a larger number of cell sites, smaller cell sites, a larger number of them, with closer spacings, and now with these extreme bandwidths you can get at numbers like 3 to 300 gigahertz, you can transmit very high speed data, you can direct the antenna with electronic steering into exactly the direction you want. That's the good news. The 300 gigahertz signal does suffer more attenuation going through buildings and going through trees. So for a bunch of reasons, the range is shorter. But as long as you're willing to accept the shorter range and build the cell sites that you communicate with accordingly, all of it comes back to a very good kind of operation. And Samsung is now making a significant investment in that area because they see that as the future. How high a frequency were you experimenting with these Wi-Fi systems that you know about at your laboratory up Bill, AC2IS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, this is AC2IS, and at 2.4 gigahertz, we're seeing, you know, poor quality connections at between 300 feet and 500 feet. Beyond 500 feet, the connection seems to break entirely, but one end of the conversation is always a very standard 802.11 kind of, you know, app.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Correctly, you're getting 300 to 500 feet at 2.4 gigahertz. And the lower frequencies will flow around trees and buildings and whatever, and through them. 2.4 4 gigs and up, starts becoming a little bit more line of sight, a little bit more pencil beam-like stuff. The attenuation from trees is a lot higher, the attenuation of buildings is a lot higher. And so that's the bad news. Some of the good news is that you can bounce signals off of things. The guys on 10 gigs that I've talked to in New Jersey, on a number of occasions, we were bouncing signals off the Verrazano Bridge and in the old days off the World Trade Center and the Empire State Building. In other words, the guys in, I can't think of the name of the mountain they were on the eastern shore of New Jersey, they were aiming dead north at either Empire or World Trade. I'm dead east, so my antenna and their antennas were aimed at right angles to each other, 90 degrees apart, but we're both looking at a common device, whether it be World Trade or Empire State Building. And I'm 33 miles airline from Empire. They were about 20 miles south of Empire, and we had beautiful communication by bouncing off of those buildings. So if you've got a steerable beam-forming network on your antenna, and you find the right object to bounce off of, even though you think there's a building or a hill in front of you, there's ways of getting around it. The guys on 10 gigs have used that with rain scouting. Let me drop. I, for instance, did talk to a guy in the Boston area where between him and I there was a mountain, and so we couldn't do it directly, but there was a rain cloud directly west of him and directly north of me. We both aimed at that rain cloud and bounced signals off of it. At 10 gigs, you get a lot of reflection off a cloud where it's raining. And that was the way that we sent signals back and forth. You do get an aurora-like sound from cloud bounce at 10 gigs. The signal doesn't have a pure tone anymore. It sounded more like a... That's the sound it had. You easily heard the Morse code, but the individual tone of the Morse code was kind of scattered. And that's because various portions of the cloud are circulating around that low-pressure center in a counterclockwise manner. Therefore, you're getting significant Doppler shift off of various portions of the cloud. But still, that allows you to send data. And so Morse code was very possible, and with the right kind of adjustment of the modulation techniques, my guess is you could send data at a medium good speed, not super high speed. In the case of bouncing off of a specific target like Empire or World Trade Center, could be sending very high-speed data. So even at 2.4 gigs, you're going to get that building bounce mode, Bill, not quite as much as you would at 10 gigs. And it's not because of the frequency, per se. Let me drop. It's more a function of how well you can direct the signal. If you've got a big enough antenna, so you've got a small enough beam on 2.4 gigs, you'll be able to send a significant amount of power at a building that you're bouncing off of. In the case of 10 gigs, a 2-foot dish gives you about a 3-degree beamwidth. The 3-degree beamwidth is essentially a flashlight beam, and I can aim that flashlight at Empire State Building and give a nice bounce. The signal being bounced off of Empire State Building was, I remember, almost 20 decibels stronger than the direct signal when we aimed directly at each other, and the signal directly at each other was weaker primarily because of Earth curvature. They weren't high enough up to clear the local horizon, if you know what I mean. AC2IS. You need more gain there, Ed. Here we go. Bill, you need a bigger dish on 2.4 gigs. AC2IS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Right, Dick. Yeah, there's no dish at all there, although they do have electronically steerable antennas. And all the 802.11 gear now, as of the 802.11n and now the AC standards, seem to really try to take advantage of multipath to improve things. They really do well with reflections and things like that. I'm going to break for a second. And another thing I recalled from way back when was that over at the old RCA facility, they, I believe, had a pair of crossed dipoles that they used for electronically steering signals to be sent to Europe. Does that sound familiar to you at all?
Okay, you said RCA facility. Maybe you're talking about a ground station, but you didn't use those words, and you said cross dipoles. In the case of ground station, it's looking up at a satellite. There's all kinds of ways that you can reuse frequencies by using clockwise and counterclockwise circular polarization, for instance, or horizontal and vertical polarization. So maybe that's what you're describing there, Bill. There's a lot of missing information there. AC2IS, K2LIW.
Yeah, Dick, there's a lot of details I do not have on that, but my understanding was that these were two dipoles arranged in an X pattern, both of them horizontal to the ground, and the idea would be to be able to steer the beam to hit different locations in Europe, so to sort of point a horizontally polarized beam towards Europe, different points in Europe.
That's a lot of ambiguity here, Bill. There was an RCA facility which was doing experimental transmissions from a 130-foot tower out in Riverhead, Long Island, up until roughly 1970. And I'm one of the guys that took that tower apart and removed that 28-foot dish. So when you say the RCA facility, you could be talking about that. You could also be talking about the Rocky Point situation, where these were great big rhombic antennas communicating with Europe. You could be talking about a ground station somewhere. So when you say the RCA facility, what town, what time, what kind of an antenna? So two dipoles parallel to the ground in an X pattern. Okay? How big were the dipoles? Was this HF or UHF? I need a few more words, Bill. AC2IS, K2LIW on the TechNet.
This is AC2IS. Yeah, my apologies, Dick. This is a very old story that I heard from some people who were essentially sort of just exploring, and they were not radio people, so this is old details I'm dredging up out of my head. It might be the Rocky Point location. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I spent some time out at Rocky Point, and they had a number of 200-foot high telephone poles. These were 100-foot telephone poles stacked on top of each other with a coupling mechanism. And so a number of rhombic antennas were 200 feet off the ground, where all the corners were held up by telephone poles. And these were the transmitting facilities to go from the Rocky Point area over to Europe. Press wireless and things like that, I believe it was. Also, McKay Radio, located in Hophog, had a great big facility at one time with a bunch of log periodic antennas, six log periodic antennas on six towers. And this was, these log periodic antennas ran between 6 and 40 megahertz. The log periodic antenna had a boom that was something like 70 feet long. Out of the entrance to MacArthur Airport, there used to be one of these antennas until a few years ago when they took it down. And those antennas have got a very broad beamwidth, aimable. And I don't remember any of the HF antennas at either McKay or RCA being parallel X-shaped dipoles parallel to the ground. That one I don't remember. If there were X dipoles parallel to the ground, I can see how one of those dipoles would favor east-west transmissions, another would favor north-south transmissions, depending on who they're talking to and the state of the ionosphere and things like that. So in those days, most of that was, let me drop it, HF communications. Nowadays, almost everything is done by satellite. Ground stations talking to a satellite, and you get some real good bandwidth out of those, and real good range. A satellite that's located over the Atlantic Ocean allows a continuous, a synchronous satellite over the Atlantic Ocean easily allows continuous communication between Europe and most of the United States. And you can transmit back and forth from news broadcasts, television, things like that. Data, voice. When it comes to satellite type voice circuits for telephone, let me drop. The disadvantage of a satellite satellite circuit is that you get something like a third of a second one way, and not counting human reaction time, two-thirds of a second round trip in that order, and therefore quite often you'll end up with a person in Europe having a phone conversation with somebody in the United States through a satellite, and you end up both talking and both listening until you start establishing a protocol where you talk for a while and say over, the other person talks for a while and then says over. That's the only way you can avoid talking on top of each other because of the latency. As such, I think telephone conversations by way of satellite is now very unpopular, not being used very much. To my knowledge, almost all international telephone circuits these days are done by fiber optics. The fiber optic path is giving you a few milliseconds of delay as opposed to a good fraction of a second delay up to a satellite and back down. 22,000 miles up and back down to a satellite is very different than going 3,300 miles across the Atlantic Ocean. Fiber is the way to go, Bill. Looks like most of our ground communications these days is going to be fiber. AC2IS, K2RIW.
This is AC2IS. Hey, Dick, let me know if I'm monopolizing the airwaves here, but I was wondering if you had time to discuss radio direction finding and some of the new single-chip radios that are out there.
When it comes to direction finding, what the hams have done on mobile installations these days at top frequencies like 2 meters and 440, the so-called Doppelscan technique, where four, six, or eight antennas are in a circular pattern on the top of the car, you cycle between those and look at the Doppler shift you get as you cycle between them at an audio rate, and it gives you the right kind of post-detection processing. It gives you a direction of arrival indication on the indicator that's inside the automobile as you're driving around. And so when it comes to fox hunting, when you set them up correctly, Glenn is one of the guys who's done it, for instance. KC2QIQ has put a fair amount of effort into that, as well as Andy DeVay2CDL and others in this club. That's one of the better ways of mobile direction finding in fox hunting. When it comes to direction finding at home, by way of aiming Yagis in various directions, you can do a pretty good job. The hams have done very little phased array techniques at home, and a Doppelscanner at a fixed location at home is not quite as desirable as it sounds at first. You get bounces off of buildings and things like that, which can confuse the system a little bit. The nice thing about mobile operation is that as you're driving along and for a short period of time, you're getting a bounce off of a building and you get a phony indication of the direction of arrival on your display while you drive. Usually that's a brief transient event as you drive by that building, and it rapidly goes away, so to speak. So if you know how to interpret, how to mentally
repeater, time out.
If you know how to mentally integrate what you're seeing on that screen as you drive, you can easily see what is the dominant direction of arrival of the fox that you're looking for. And with training, you learn how to avoid the spurious directions of arrival you get as you drive by reflecting objects. So when you're mobile and you use that extra brain power and experience, direction finding becomes a bit more of a science. From a fixed location with reflections, life is a little bit more complicated. I think that's some of what you're looking for. By the way, when it comes to single chip radios, let me drop. There are quite a few of them out there. The Baofeng radios, for instance, that many of us are buying, when you look inside, you'll find out that 95% of that radio is all contained within one chip. And that chip probably costs about $10. You're getting a lot of electronics in that tiny little package. And so, we amateurs don't very often build our own radios anymore. When you can buy a radio for a few hours of your labor, and to build it would take you a few weeks of your time. It's obvious that one gives you a lot more bang for the dollar than the other one. AC2IS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, this is AC2IS. I was wondering if you had three antennas spaced apart, a quarter wave apart, and you were doing SDR kind of things, what kind of a Doppler system could you get out of that? And also, I think there's one of the new SI chips out there that's going for like $6 a piece in quantity, if you're going to buy 10,000, something like that.
Believe it or not, this is somewhat relevant to direct frequency synthesis. If I was building a direct frequency synthesizer, and I'm doing it with a network that is feeding digital signals into a digital-to-analog converter, and if I set it up in such a way that I've got 8 or 16 amplitude steps where I could make a staircase command, so to speak, where the steps out of my digital-to-analog converter trace out a sine wave with reasonably high accuracy and a little bit of filtering after it, you got a nice sine wave coming out of it. So if I've got 8 or 16 steps in my direct frequency synthesizer going into that D to A, I can make a very nice sine wave. As I start using less and less steps, 16 steps, 8 steps, 4 steps, and the limit is 2 steps, a positive or a negative voltage, and you flip back and forth between the two, you're generating a square wave, and you're trying to make a filter that and make a sine wave out of it. As you use less and less steps, you develop more and more aliasing problems. In other words, depending on what frequency you're requesting versus the clock rate at which your system is running, you start generating other undesired products that in some cases are hard to filter. So as you create a more and more pure original sine wave by having more and more steps, the purity of what you get out is better, the filtering required is less, and the life becomes simpler. Can I drop? There's a similar thing going on when it comes to the number of antennas you use in a Doppler scan. You could find out how far north of east or south of east or north of west or south of west your signal is if you had two antennas, one north and south of the other, and you're looking broadside, east and west, and getting a direction of arrival. You're going to have very little information when it comes to due north and south. So you could do some Doppler scanning with two monopoles. I don't recommend it. Three is better, four is better, six is better, eight is really getting there. As you use more and more antennas, and you rotate around those antennas correctly, it's the equivalent of having more and more steps in that direct frequency synthesizer. In one case, you're frequency synthesizing a sine wave signal. In the other case, you're doing a kind of steering of the beam around the compass. That's not quite what's going on, but you're doing the phase equivalent of it. So you can make it work with three antennas, but it's not going to work as well, in my opinion. And I think that's the main reason when it comes to the kits you can buy, Bill. I don't think any of them have only three antennas. ACQIS, K2LAW, and the TechNet.
Dick, this is AC2IS here. It seems like four antennas is typical, and here's a possibly dumb question. It seems like the exact frequency that you're doing the direction finding on is somehow set by the receiver that you have connected to the Doppler direction finding gear. But I can't figure out how the information of what station is being tuned by the receiver gets to the Doppler direction finding gear so it knows what frequency to listen on.
If I'm doing a fox hunt on 146.25 megahertz, for instance, the receiver that's connected to my Doppler scan will be tuned to that frequency. As the system turns on and off its switches, its diodes or whatever, that enables one of those antennas at a time, and you're going around that cycle at an audio rate. You might be going around that cycle, I'm not sure, but it might be 800 times per second. What really happens is that, let me give you an example. Let's assume that the signal you're listening to is coming from the north. And I've got a total of four antennas in the system. An antenna at 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock, and 9 o'clock. As I switch between the 6 o'clock antenna and the 3 o'clock antenna in the sequence, the 3 o'clock antenna is closer to the source than the 6 o'clock antenna. Therefore, at that instant of time, I jump positive in phase. I'm now, for that next millisecond, I'm listening to an antenna that's closer to the source. And when I go from 3 o'clock to the 12 o'clock antenna, again, I'm seeing an advancing phase. When I go from the 12 o'clock to the 9 o'clock antenna, I'm seeing a retarding phase. And again, a retarding phase when I go from 9 o'clock to the 6 o'clock antenna. So you get a cyclic change in phase of the signal you're listening to on that exact frequency as you flip around on those antennas in a cyclic manner. And you're always going in the same direction, clockwise or counterclockwise, and you're doing it pretty fast. Let me drop. Those instantaneous phase shifts of getting closer and further from the source in a cyclic manner. Cyclic phase shift is FM. Is FM phase shift? Is phase shift FM? The answer is yes. And it's just an integration between the two. What comes out of the discriminator is going to have a cyclic signal at something like 600 hertz. If I'm going around the circle 600 times per second, there's going to be a 600 hertz component coming out of that discriminator. If I tune my electronics after that discriminator to look for the 600 hertz component in my example and look at the phase angle of the 600 hertz component compared to the phase angle of my commands to those four antennas, and I compare the two, I say, aha, that signal is coming from the north. So it's a phase comparison system coming out of a discriminator where you're making phony FM by moving the antenna very rapidly. You couldn't do that if you put the antenna on the perimeter of a turntable and turn the turntable very rapidly, you'd also get doppelscan. Because of centrifugal motion, the antenna would be flying apart, if you know what I mean. Electronically, you're doing the equivalent of moving the antenna on a carousel. AC2IS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
This is AC2IS. I think I follow that, and the discriminator is in the radio itself, but in order to light up LEDs on your direction finder to say what direction the signal is coming from, that information has to get from the radio back to the direction finder. Is that coming through the audio component, the audio out on the radio, back to the direction finder?
You've got it, Bill. The audio output on the radio going back to the electronics that's commanding those switches is doing all of that processing and giving you that answer. We're about to run out of time. You guys have just listened to TechNet number 1457 of the series that began in September of 1982. Most likely, Paul, John, and I, and Hal, and Bernie, and the other guys will be back next week. And 73, you all, be kind to each other. Don't sweat the small stuff. Oh, by the way, it's mostly small stuff. Don't let the stuff get you angry. And radio is a fun thing to study. There's a lot to it. I'm going to pass it over to John for some other words if he wants to add them. KC2WGB, K2LAW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yep, great net. I want to thank everybody for participating. And we'll have another showing next week. But I want everybody to enjoy, be healthy, and have a good time. And don't let these things worry you. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
And this TechNet is continuously evolving. We evolved the menu by which we conducted. And tonight you guys heard of a chat room being established. It's sort of like saying radios repair while you wait. Well, the TechNet is modified while you wait.
Get into that chat room again, Dick.
Yeah, we now have a chat room. Do you want the website for the chat room? That sounds like N2MB. Is that true?
It is. Just before this thing goes off, I just went into the website, yes.
Okay, the URL is www.urwebchat.com. URwebchat, Uncle Ray Romeo, webchat.com/technet. So I'll repeat that. www.uncleradiourwebchat.com/technet. N2MB, K2LAW, you got it, Barry.
Okay, I'm going to look it up on the computer and see if it comes up. Thanks, Dick. Good night tonight. It was fun listening to you.
You now understand where the noise is coming from with a 50-ohm resistor? I can give you a pop quiz on that, Barry.
Yeah, but I wouldn't have to answer the question. I can't believe this thing is still on. It's 2:02.
Understand. Okay. You've heard enough of it that you're absorbing that information even though you don't completely understand it yet. And it's going to make sense downrange. Hang in there, Barry.
Okay. No sweat. And I think I've absorbed it a long time ago. Phone trace, Dick. Into Mike Bravo, Rocky Way.
Yeah, you're the guy that lived with all of that noise of the universe in the background of the moon. And learn to live with it. Bye-bye, you all. Keep your eyes up, you're clear.
URwebwhat.com?
Uncle Ray Romeo Web Chat.
Someone came in as guest. Is that Barry. Yeah, it's just Joe's in there, WJ2B. Hello, Joe.
I tried it when they gave it out. It didn't work. missing the call.